content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. For our first article today, it's from the Science Department, and it's entitled, a, quote, chicken from hell could rewrite the story of dinosaurs' final days. This was written by Kyle Atkins-Weltman and Eric Snively, who are respectively a PhD student and a professor at Oklahoma State University. Were dinosaurs already on their way out when an asteroid hit Earth 66 million years ago, ending the Cretaceous period, which had begun about 79 million years earlier? It's a question that has vexed paleontologists like us for more than 40 years. In the late 1970s, debate began about whether dinosaurs were at their peak or in decline before their big extinction. At that crucial moment, what was really happening to dinosaur diversity? Discovery, identification, and description of new dinosaurs provide vital clues. This is where our work comes in. Close examination of what we thought was a juvenile specimen of a known species of dinosaur from this time period revealed that it was actually part of an adult from a completely new species. Our work, focusing on the life stage of our specimen, demonstrates that dinosaur diversity may not have been declining before the asteroid hit, but rather that more species from this time period are yet to be discovered, potentially even through reclassification of fossils already in museum collections. Our new study focused on four hind limb bones, a femur, a tibia, and two metatarsals. They were unearthed in South Dakota in the rocks of the Hell Creek Formation and date to the final 2 million years of the Cretaceous period. When we first examined the bones, we identified them as belonging to a family of dinosaurs known as Caenanathids, a group of bird-like dinosaurs that had toothless beaks, long legs, and short tails. Direct fossil and inferred evidence indicates that these dinosaurs were likely covered in complex feathers, much like modern birds. The only known species of Caenanathid from this time and period was Anzu, sometimes called the, quote, chicken from hell. Covered in feathers and sporting wings and a toothless beak, Anzu was roughly 450 to 750 pounds. Despite its fearsome nickname, though, its diet is a matter of debate. It was likely an omnivore, eating both plant material and small animals. Because our specimen was significantly smaller than Anzu, we simply assumed it was a juvenile. We chalked up the anatomical differences we noticed to its juvenile status and smaller size, and figured the animal would have changed had it continued to grow. Anzu specimens are rare, and no definite juveniles have been published in the scientific literature. So we were excited to potentially learn more about how it grew and changed throughout its lifetime by looking inside its bones. Just as with a tree's rings, bone records rings called lines of arrested growth. Each annual line represents a part of a year when the animal's growth slowed. They tell us how old an animal was and how fast or slow it was growing. We cut through the middle of three of the bones so we could microscopically examine the internal anatomy of the cross sections. What we saw completely uprooted our initial assumptions. In a juvenile, we would expect lines of arrested growth in the bone to be widely spaced, indicating rapid growth, and with even spacing between the lines from the inside to the outside surface of the bone. Here, we saw that the latter lines were spaced progressively closer together, indicating that this animal's growth had slowed, and it was nearly at its adult size. This was no juvenile. Instead, it was an adult of an entirely new species, which we dubbed Eneophron infernalis. The name means Pharaoh's Dawn Chicken from Hell, referencing the nickname of its larger cousin, Anzu. Traits unique to the species include ankle bones fused to the tibia and a well-developed ridge on one of its foot bones. These weren't features a young Anzu would outgrow, but rather unique aspects of the smaller Eneophron. With this new evidence, we started making thorough comparisons with other members of the family to determine where Eneophron infernalis fit within the group. It also inspired us to re-examine other bones previously believed to be Anzu, as we now knew that more Caenanathid dinosaurs lived in western North America during that time. One specimen, a partial foot bone smaller than our new specimen, appeared to be distinct from both Anzu and Eneophron. Where once there was one chicken from hell, now there were two, and evidence for a third. One large, Anzu, weighing as much as a grizzly bear, one medium, Eneophron, about the weight of a human, and one small and yet unnamed. Comparing Hell Creek with older fossil formations, such as the famous Dinosaur Park Formation of Alberta, which preserves dinosaurs that lived 76.5 million to 74.4 million years ago, we find not only the same number of Caenanathid species, but also the same size classes. There, we have Caenanathus, comparable to Anzu, Chirostenopes, comparable to Eneophron, and Cydippes, comparable to the third species we found evidence for. These parallels in both species count and relative sizes offer compelling evidence that Caenanathids remained stable throughout the last part of the Cretaceous period. Our new discovery suggests that this dinosaur group was not declining in diversity at the very end of the Cretaceous period. These fossils show that new species are still to be discovered and support the idea that at least part of the pattern of decreasing diversity is the result of sampling and preservation biases. Did large dinosaurs go extinct the way a Hemingway character quipped when he went broke, gradually, and then suddenly? Although plenty of questions remain outstanding in this extinction debate, Eneophron adds evidence that Caenanathids were doing quite well for themselves before the asteroid hit and ruined everything. Hopefully I wasn't too far off in the pronunciations of those scientific terms from that article. Next, an opinion piece on the economy entitled, "What Would It Take to Convince Americans That the Economy is Fine?" When it comes to prosperity, Americans trust feelings more than facts. By Roge Karma. What was the worst moment for the American economy in the past half century? You might think it was the last wheezing months of the 1970s when oil prices more than doubled, inflation reached double digits, and the U.S. sank into its second recession of the decade. Or the 2008 financial collapse and Great Recession. Or perhaps it was when COVID hit and millions of people abruptly lost their job. All good guesses, and all wrong if surveys of the American public are to be believed. According to the University of Michigan surveys of consumers, the most widely cited measure of consumer sentiment, that moment was actually June of 2022. Inflation hit 9% that month, and no one knew if it would go higher still. A recession seemed imminent. Objectively, it's hard to claim that the economy was in worse shape that month than it had been at those other cataclysmic times, but substantial pessimism was nonetheless explicable. Over the next 18 months, however, the economy improved rapidly and in nearly every way. Inflation plummeted to near its pre-pandemic level, unemployment reached historic lows, GDP boomed, and wages rose. The turnaround, by most standard economic measures, was unprecedented. Yet the American people continued to give the economy the kind of approval ratings traditionally reserved for used car salesmen. Last June, the White House launched a campaign to celebrate Bidenomics. The administration's strong job creation record and big investments in manufacturing and clean energy. The effort flopped so badly that within months, Democrats were begging the president to abandon it altogether. Some kind of irreconcilable difference seemed to have opened up between public opinion and traditional markers of economic health, as many op-eds and news reports noted. The economy is great. Why are Americans in such a rotten mood? The Wall Street Journal asked in early November. What's causing bad vibes in the economy? The New York Times wondered a few weeks later. Terms like vibecession and the great disconnect were coined and spread. More recently, consumer sentiment has improved. After falling for months, it suddenly rebounded in December and January, posting its largest two-month gain in more than 30 years, even though the economy itself barely changed at all. Yet, as of this writing, sentiment remains low by historical standards, nothing like the sunny outlook that prevailed before the pandemic. What's going on? The question involves the psychology of money and of politics. Its answer will shape the outcome of the presidential election in November. The toll of inflation on the American psyche is undoubtedly part of the story. That people hate high inflation is not a novel observation. The Federal Reserve has long been obsessed with preventing another 70s-style inflationary spiral. Its patron saint is Paul Volcker, the former Fed chair who famously broke that spiral by jacking up interest rates, which plunged the economy into a recession. But although experts and political leaders know that inflation matters, the way they understand the phenomenon is very different from how ordinary people experience it, and that alone may explain why sentiment stayed low for so long and has only now begun to rise. When economists talk about inflation, they are often referring to an index of prices meant to represent the goods and services a typical household buys in a year. Each item in the index is weighted by how much it is spent on it annually. So, for instance, because the average household spends about a third of its income on housing, the price of housing, an amalgam of rents and home prices, determines a third of the inflation rate. But the goods that people spend the most money on tend to be quite different from those that they pay the most attention to. Consumers are reminded of the price of food every time they visit a supermarket or restaurant, and the price of gas is plastered in giant numbers on every street corner. Also, the purchase of these items can't be postponed. Things like a new couch or flat-screen TV, in contrast, are purchased so rarely that many people don't even remember how much they paid for one, let alone how much they cost today. The irony is that consumers spend a lot more, on average, on expensive big-ticket items than they do on groceries or takeout, which means the prices we pay the most attention to don't contribute very much to overall inflation numbers. Less than a tenth of the average consumer's budget is spent at the supermarket. Some measures of inflation, core and super core inflation among them, exclude food and energy prices altogether. That is reasonable if you're a Fed official focused on how to set interest rates, because energy and food prices are often extremely sensitive to temporary fluctuations. But in practice, these measures overlook the prices that matter most to consumers. This dynamic alone goes a long way toward explaining the gap between the economy and Americans' perceptions of it. Even as core inflation fell below 3% over the course of 2023, food prices increased by about 6%, twice as fast as they had grown over the previous 20 years. I think that explains a huge part of the disconnect, Paul Donovan, the chief economist at UBS Global Wealth Management, told me. You won't convince any consumer that inflation is under control when food prices are rising that fast. Consumers say as much when you ask them. In a recent poll commissioned by The Atlantic, respondents were asked what factors they consider when deciding how the national economy is doing. The price of groceries led the list, and 60% of respondents placed it among the top three, more even than the share that shows inflation. This isn't exactly a new development. In 2002, Donovan told me, Italian consumers were convinced that prices were soaring by nearly 20%, even though actual inflation was a stable 2%. It turned out that people were basing their estimates on the cost of a cup of espresso, which had abruptly risen as coffee makers rounded up their prices after the introduction of the euro. What's more, most people don't care about the inflation rate so much as they care about prices themselves. If inflation runs at 10% for a year and then suddenly shrinks to 2%, the damage of the past year has not been undone. Prices are still dramatically higher than they were. Overall, prices are nearly 20% higher now than they were before the pandemic, with grocery prices 25% higher. When asked in a survey last fall what improvement in the economy they would most like to see, 64% of respondents said lower prices on goods, services, and gas. What about wages? Even adjusted for inflation, they have been rising since June of 2022 and recently surpassed their pre-pandemic levels, meaning that typical Americans' paychecks go further than they did prior to the inflation spike. But wages haven't increased faster than food prices, and most people think about wage and price increases very differently. A raise tends to feel like something we've earned, Betsy Stevenson, an economist at the University of Michigan, told me. Then we go to the grocery store, and it feels like those just rewards are being unfairly taken away. If inflation is, in fact, the main reason American people have been so down on the economy and its future, then the story is likely to have a happy ending, and soon. My great-grandmother loved to reminisce about the days when a can of Coke cost a nickel. She didn't, however, believe that the country was on the verge of economic calamity because she now had to spend a dollar or more for the same beverage. Just as surely as people despise price increases, we also get used to them in the end. A recent analysis by Ryan Cummings and Neil Mahoney, two Stanford economists and former policy advisors in the Biden administration, found that it takes 18 to 24 months for lower inflation to fully show up in consumer sentiment. People eventually adjust, Mahoney told me. They just don't adjust at the rate the statistical agencies produce inflation data. Mahoney and Cummings posted their study on December 4, 2023, 18 months after inflation peaked in June of 2022. As if on cue, consumer sentiment began surging that month. There is another story you can tell about consumer sentiment today, however, one that has less to do with what's happening in grocery stores and more to do with the peculiarities of tribal identity. It's well established that partisans on both sides become more negative about the economy when the other party controls the presidency. But this phenomenon is not symmetrical. In a November analysis, Mahoney and Cummings found that when a Democrat occupies the White House, Republicans' economic outlook declines by more than twice as much as Democrats does when the situation is reversed. Consumer sentiment data from the polling firm Civics and Pew Research Center showed that Republicans' view of the economy has barely budged since hitting an all-time low in the summer of 2022. Meanwhile, although sentiment among Democrats has recovered to nearly where it stood before inflation began to rise in 2021, it remains well below its level at the end of the Obama administration. It may never return to its previous heights. Over the past decade, the belief that the economy is rigged in favor of the rich and powerful has become central to progressive self-identity. Among Democrats ages 18 to 34, who tend to be more progressive than older Democrats, positive news of capitalism fell from 56 to 40% between 2010 and 2019, according to Gallup. Dim views of the broader economic system may be limiting how positively some Democrats feel about the economy, even when one of their own occupies the Oval Office. According to a CNN poll in late January, 63% of Democrats ages 45 and older believed that the economy was on the upswing, but only 35% of younger Democrats believe the same. To fully embrace the economy's strength would be to sacrifice part of the modern progressive's ideological sense of self. The media may be contributing to economic gloom for people of every political stripe. According to Mahoney, one possible explanation for Republicans' disproportionate economic negativity when a Democrat is in office is the fact that the news sources many Republicans consume, namely right-wing media like Fox News, tend to be more brazenly partisan than the sources Democrats consume, which tend to be a balance of mainstream and partisan media. But mainstream media have also gotten more negative about the economy in recent years, regardless of who's held the presidency. According to a new analysis by the Brookings Institute, from 1988 to 2016, the sentiment of economic news coverage in mainstream newspapers tracked closely with measures such as inflation, employment, and the stock market. Then, during Donald Trump's presidency, coverage became more negative than the economic fundamentals would have predicted. After Joe Biden took office, the gap widened. Journalists have long focused more on surfacing problems than on highlighting successes. Bringing problems to light is an essential part of the job. But the more recent shift could be explained by the same economic pessimism afflicting many young liberals. Many newspaper journalists, after all, are liberals themselves. In other words, the media's negativity could be both a reflection and a source of today's economic pessimism. What happens to consumer sentiment in the coming months will depend on how much it is still being dragged down by frustration with higher prices, which will likely dissipate as opposed to how much is being limited by a combination of Republican partisanship and Democratic pessimism, which are less likely to change. Will the place that it finally settles in come September matter to the election? How people say they are feeling about the economy in an election year, alongside more direct measures of economic health, such as GDP growth and disposable income, has in the past been a good predictor of whom voters choose as president. A healthy economy and good sentiment strongly favor the incumbent. Despite all the abnormalities of 2020, a pandemic, national protests, a uniquely polarizing president, economic models that factored in both economic fundamentals and sentiment predicted the result and margin of that year's presidential election quite accurately, and much more so than polling. According to analysis by political scientists John Sides, Chris Tusanovich, and Lynn Vavarek, it is of course possible that consumer sentiment is becoming more performance metric than it used to be, a statement about who you are rather than how you really feel, and perhaps less reliable as a result. Still, the story that voters have in their heads about the economy clearly matters. If that story were influenced solely by the prices at the pump and the grocery store or the number of well-paying jobs, then, absent another crisis, we would expect the mood to be buoyant this fall, significantly helping Biden's prospect for re-election. But the stories we tell ourselves are shaped by everything from the news we read to the political messages we hear, to the identities we adopt. And, for better or worse, those stories have yet to be fully written. Now back to science for a short story. Anchorage Fell in Love with a White Raven by Ash Adams. Throughout the fall, a rare white raven breakfasted at a McDonald's and lunched at a Wendy's in Anchorage, Alaska. Photographs confirmed word-of-mouth reports. A Facebook group that now has more than 20,000 followers is regularly updated with the raven's whereabouts. On a gray weekend in November, the bird showed up on a dumpster near the Wendy's, then on various lampposts, roofs, and snow mounds. People in Anchorage see ravens all the time, and here we're very used to ravens, Rick Sinnott, a retired Anchorage area wildlife biologist who still lives in town, told me, but they're black ravens. In northern places, ravens are as defining as the weather. During the darkest days of the year, they cluster in cities, scavenging for food in dumpsters and trash cans. On windy days, small clouds of black wings twirl between buildings. Birds as dark as silhouettes bob down the streets. The ravens are so abundant that you might not see them unless you're trying to, or unless one is white. Each generation seems to get one in Alaska, Sinnott said of the white raven. Nobody knows a number, but it's rare. Another off-color raven, he recalled, made news in the 1990s. It, like the one people in Anchorage are now tracking, was leucistic, born with less pigmentation than most common ravens. The bird has shockingly white feathers, and unlike a bird presenting with the pink eyes of albinism, its eyes are light blue. Stories that cast Raven as a clever trickster who stole the sun are depicted in well-loved children's books in Alaska. And since the leucistic raven's appearance, stories from indigenous cultures in Alaska about the significance of the white raven have been circulating on social media and among the people who have come to see the raven. According to the indigenous culture, Raven was originally white and stole the moon, the stars, and the sun to give the universe light. After the theft, Raven escaped through a soot hole and turned black. Some people say the white raven is a blessing, and some a curse, but I think it's a good thing. Rumors have spread among the raven's followers that the white raven is less likely to survive the winter than other ravens, an idea the Sinnott said is not unfounded, but is missing the larger point. While white feathers wear faster than black feathers, survival is a feat for any raven. Most ravens don't live to adulthood, he told me. They're eaten as eggs, or the eggs don't survive, or the eggs hatch and the nestlings are eaten, or they starve to death somehow because one of the parents is killed, and on and on. There is so much that can go wrong. At least for now, the bird is giving people a reason to come out of the dark days and look at the sky. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.